We'll call the Subcommittee on Employee Relations to order here, and we'll get started. We know we're going to have some members coming here in a little bit. Let's take a quick, you just want to glance through the minutes that we have had, everyone, just to make sure that they're okay.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the minutes. Do we have a quorum?
We thank you, Senator, but we're going to wait until we have a quorum here. I think we need one more for a quorum, don't we? Not mistaken. All right. Let's just move on here. Update on bargaining. Maybe we could have Commissioner Holmes. You want to come up and... You know, being that we're going to be asking questions, maybe Mr. Dale, maybe you could join Commissioner at the table as well.
Thanks for that, Craig.
Welcome, and I guess we'll let you start, Commissioner. We're looking for an update, and I'm sure there's going to be questions as well.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Barbara Holmes. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Labor Relations at Minnesota Management and Budget, and in that capacity, I am the Chief Labor Negotiator. As I have discussed with this committee before, our labor contract negotiations move in a triple-track sort of process where we negotiate with the AFSCME units, with the MAPE unit, and then we negotiate with all-union coalition on the medical, dental, and other insurance benefits. Since May of 2011, we have been meeting with all these groups. Negotiations with the all-union coalition on insurance issues proceeded to the point where essentially the unresolved insurance issues move to the full, to the master negotiating tables of AFSCME and MAPE. That happened in about January. And for it moved to those tables for final resolution. The last negotiation sessions that we held with AFSCME and MAPE were on February 29th and March 1st. During the evening of March 1st, the state made an offer to the unions to settle the 2011-2013 collective bargaining agreements, and both AFSCME and MAPE, the negotiating teams at that session, rejected the state's offer to settle. I believe that you are all aware that the law gives the right to strike only to what we call non-essential units. That's what the law calls them. And those are the units that we were in negotiations with. The other, what are called essential units, like the corrections guards, the nurses, the supervisors, engineers, they do not have the right to strike, and they have to go to arbitration. We have to go to arbitration if we can't resolve their contract. And at that point, it goes to an outside neutral arbitrator to resolve all the outstanding issues. In the past, the employers offered at the AFSCME and MAPE units would be sent out to the full union membership for a vote to either accept the state's offer or to reject the offer and strike. However, state law also permits the employer and the union to mutually agree to go to arbitration if they can't reach agreements. After the AFSCME and MAPE negotiating team rejected the employer's offer to settle on March 1st, the mediator from the Bureau of Mediation Services proposed that the state's offer be sent out for a vote to either accept or reject and pursue voluntary interest arbitration. The employer and the union agreed with the mediator's proposal to pursue voluntary interest arbitration if the employer's offer is rejected. The employer agreed to this because of its desire to avoid the potential large-scale disruption in state services that could result if 28,000 state employees were to go on strike. Given that state government was shut down this past July during the state shutdown, the governor believed that it was in the public's interest to resolve any of the remaining issues through voluntary interest arbitration. Currently, the MAPE and AFSCME unions are in the process of taking the employer's offer to settle to their individual memberships. The result of the vote by the unions, we expect we will hear about that sometime on or after April 17th. The executive branch has a longstanding practice of not making any sort of public comments on the particulars of any offers or agreements that have been reached until after union members have had an opportunity to vote upon them. There are a number of legal reasons that we do this. For one, under PELRA, which is the Public Employers Labor Relations Act that this legislature has enacted, the unions are the exclusive representative of the employees, and it is their right and their responsibility to communicate with its members about contract negotiations. The employer risks an unfair labor practice lawsuit if it interferes with these communications during the voting process. Senator Perry and Senator Drazkowski of Reese recently asked me to provide the specifics of the employer's offer to settle, along with the costs of this offer. I have regrettably been unable to honor their request because the negotiations are under the guise of the mediation process being mediated by the Bureau of Mediation Services. There is a data practices statute that has a specific provision about this situation. Specifically, it's Minnesota Statutes 13.7908, Subdivision 2. And it states, data received and maintained by the staff or commissioner of the Bureau of Mediation Services during the course of providing mediation services to the parties to a labor dispute are classified as protected non-public data. You also may be aware that the Department of Administration has a particular department called the Information Policy Analysis Division. I think we always refer to it as IPAD. And they have issued they issue regularly opinions regarding the Data Practices Act, and there was a similar situation that arose several years back. Similar to this particular situation, and IPAD stated that, and I'm quoting from a decision, the final spreadsheet that shows the total cost of the mediator's proposal and any documents in the district's possession that show what other language agreements have been made are classified as protected non-public data. As you also are undoubtedly aware, the unions are not covered by the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act, and they have posted on their website the details of the employer's offer to settle. Regardless, as a government official, I am still prohibited from talking about those details because of the Data Practices Act. If the vote, which we will again know approximately April 17th. If the vote is to accept the employer's offer to settle, we will bring the negotiated agreement before this subcommittee for its review and approval or rejection. If the vote is to reject the employer's offer to settle and proceed to arbitration, I would be glad to return to this subcommittee and provide you with a review of the arbitration process.
Thank you, Ms. Holmes. I'll start. I have a few questions, and I guess maybe if you're bound by the Data Privacy Act, maybe you can help me understand what's in a flyer that was sent out. I don't know if you've seen this flyer or not.
Yes, I am aware that
the AFSCME. So, Ms. Holmes, according to the flyer, is it true the employer wants state employees to pay $45 million more for health insurance?
Mr. Chairman, I really don't mean to be difficult, but I don't feel under the Data Practices Act that I'm allowed to talk about the details that were discussed in mediation. I have read other data practices opinions where it says even though an outside party isn't restricted by it, and they put that information out there, I still am, and I don't want to violate that act.
All right, Ms. Holmes, I understand that, but I think is you know I'll ask you also. They give an example here, stating that access level 2, the first dollar deductible, would increase from $140 to $300 for singles, and for families it would increase from $280 to $600. Is that also true? How about this, Ms. Holmes? How about this? They state here, AFSCME Council 5, that the employer also wants us to pay more for doctor visits. Out-of-pocket cost would increase from $22 to $37 per visit for the employee to take the health assessment. Is that true?
I don't feel I can comment on that. I can tell you that that would be a way if the employer wanted to had costs that it wanted the employees to pay for, that would be one of the numerous ways that they could have those costs paid for.
Ms. Holmes, let me ask you then, another part of this flyer says the employer, the cruelest proposal would impose a 10% coinsurance. They call it the cruelest proposal would impose a 10% coinsurance on members who require expensive specialty drugs for cancer and other ailments. Is that true?
I can't comment on that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Holmes, are they required to tell the truth when they're asking their employees to vote? And if they mislead their employees, does that have an impact on the arbitration process?
Ms. Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, to say are they required to be accurate in the information, I don't have any control over what they say. Minnesota Management and Budget doesn't have any control over what they say or what they put out there.
And Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Holmes, it's being new to the arbitration and employee negotiation process, what I would like to know is that if the information here is fundamentally misleading and this offer is rejected, are they bargaining in good faith?
Ms. Holmes.
That's an interesting question, and I imagine that it would be a decision ultimately for a court of law.
You know, there's a couple other things here, Ms. Holmes, that I think, you know, what bothers me here is that citizens are seeing the side of the unions, yet we're bound by data privacy because they say here, worse yet, the employer wants to freeze our wages for the first 12 months of a 24-month contract with no steps the second year. Another statement is another unacceptable proposal would force new hires to serve 20 years instead of 10 years to qualify for a reduced correctional early retirement incentive. This is being printed, handed out publicly, yet we as citizens of the state, as this committee, have no right to know then what the offer was so that we can counterbalance what's being said to the membership?
Mr. Chairman, under the Data Practices Act, looking just at that provision, that would seem to be true. I guess the only thing I would say is certainly in the context of an arbitration, the state would be willing to or would be able to counter any sort of misinformation or misinterpretation that they felt that the union was making it in their communications. They'd be able to certainly inform the arbitrator of what the opinion of the employer was on that. And also, I I guess that the process as written right now anticipates that your input and your comments will come and your authority to approve or reject come once we either have a negotiated agreement or an arbitration decision.
Chairman Perry.
Representative Benson. There's two Bensons.
That's right. Representative Benson.
Yeah, Assistant Commissioner Holmes. Understanding that the labor units would be bound by regulations from the Labor Department, isn't it true, though, if they were communicating things that were untrue, that a member of the union could file an unfair labor charge against their own union?
Ms. Holmes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, I am not an expert on the charges that members of unions could file. I'm not sure it would be an unfair labor practice. That's usually an action that's either taken by an employer or a union against the other party. So I'm unable to answer that question.
Representative Benson.
Yeah, would the other representative at the table understand the question so they could answer whether or not an employee of a labor union could file a charge against their leadership regarding miscommunications about contract offers?
Please state your name for the record.
Chair Perry, my name is Christopher Dale. I work for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. I'm the Senior System Director for Employee Relations. Chair, Senator Benson, Representative Benson, members of the committee, in my experience, the filing of unfair labor practices is a little bit like filing lawsuits and or having, if I may say so, an opinion. They can be filed for good reasons or bad reasons, and often are. So I would say that it's probably true that a member could file an unfair labor practice over that.
Representative Benson, by the way, we do have a quorum. Let the record show.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So do you know the regulations well enough to know whether or not that would be a charge in standing? Would that be a good charge?
Mr. Dale?
Chair Perry, Representative Benson, to some degree it's speculation as to what exactly the nature of the claim would be by a union member at that point. And generally speaking, our exclusive representatives, as do private sector unions, have a duty to fairly represent their members. And so it seems logical that the nature of the claim would be in a DFR, duty of fair representation type claim.
Thank you.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Holmes, kind of along the questioning we had earlier, so what I'm hearing is there's really no mechanism in place to ensure the integrity of the communication to the union of what the offer is. Is that accurate?
Ms. Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, in my awareness, there is no express mechanism that we can use to control what they say. In the absence of, to the extent that they misrepresented, that possibly could be grounds for an unfair labor practice, as Senator Benson mentioned.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I assume then the administration, your office, et cetera, are probably part of your approach to this process, I would expect would be monitoring and keeping an account of what is communicated during the discussions and process with the union and their membership. Is that accurate, or is that a function that your office is endeavoring to pursue during this process?
Ms. Holmes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, we certainly are made aware either by looking at their website or through other information that's provided to us, some of what they're saying to their members, not everything. Some of those meetings that they have with their members are private. But yes, we are aware. We look at what they're saying out there. I can tell you that in the past, in the present. Perhaps we always don't agree quite with their interpretation of what may be said, but as you know, there are many different ways to interpret or advocate certain issues, and to find that line where someone is crossing the line in terms of actual misrepresentation isn't that simple.
So, Ms. Holmes, then, maybe you can help me with this. On the same sheet of paper, it appears that the unions have asked that there's no changes to plan design for level one and guaranteed access level two. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, I can't discuss the details of the state's offer to settle with the unions that we've met because we are in mediation.
So other than reading this, that the unions also want an increase in the maximum dental benefit amount from $1,000 to $1,500, and the fact that the union's proposal is to maintain steps in both years of the contract, and the fact that they want a 2% wage increase effective July 1st, 2012, and an additional 1.5% in the final pay period of June 2013, which is a $500 lump sum. You can't deny or comment on what they've actually put out publicly?
No, I don't believe I can comment, but since that is a publication of their own and they're saying what their proposal is, that probably speaks for itself.
Ms. Holmes, do you believe the unions are dragging their feet in the negotiations?
Not anymore.
Will we see a contract before the end of the session?
If the end of the session is... if the end of the session is the end of this month, I know there's a lot of talk about when it is going to be... let's say that the end of the session is the end of April, and we get a vote in on April 17th, or we're made aware that they have accepted the state's offer to settle, then I believe we will be able to get something to you, although it will be in that last week of flurry, which I know on earlier occasions, I remember Senator Benson was concerned about receiving something at the last minute. But if they reject the offer and we go to arbitration, I don't believe the full legislature will receive. The legislature will be gone by the time we have an arbitration, and it will be this committee that would receive the arbitration decision for rejection or approval.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Ms. Holmes. Can you walk us through what that arbitration timeline would look like? You know, the selection of the arbitrating panel or person, and then and how that that manifests itself, and then how long the parties will have to prepare, and then the 30 days or whatever it's deemed necessary for the ruling and so on. Can you walk us through that?
Well, I can tell you that from the time that you decide to go to arbitration to the point that you get to arbitration, the amount of time that's necessary to prepare for that in this sort of a case, which is pretty complicated because you may have two unions and certainly some complicated insurance provisions, we're looking at a couple of months before we would get in front of an arbitrator. And that assumes... that depends on who we pick and their availability, but it will be a couple months. And then the arbitrator is required to issue his or her decision within 30 days of that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Holmes. So if the legislature were to pass legislation in the next 4 weeks, hard coding certain benefits and things, would that have the ability to impact, and obviously the governor would need to sign that, but let's make that probably unrealistic assumption, But if we pass legislation, could we actually directly impact the settlement legislatively?
Ms. Holmes?
Yes, you could impact the settlement, prospective settlements, by laws that were passed by the legislature and signed into law by the governor.
Representative Downey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Holmes. So if we were able to, by our best estimation, ascertain perhaps what the state's offer is, and I appreciate we're not going to get any information, so we'd be doing our best guess. But if we passed legislation and the governor signed it, we could actually, through legislative will, direct the course of the negotiations as well. Is that a fair statement?
Ms. Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, yes, I believe that's an accurate statement.
Representative?
I'll just make a statement. I mean, this whole process with this Employee Relations Commission, is, at least from a timing standpoint, is clearly broken. The facade that somehow this commission and then the legislature would actually have an ability to assert its will in the process when, in fact, the process is entirely blind to us. We have no idea what the state's offer is. We have some idea what the union's position is. But for us to think that this commission and the legislative oversight of that process and approval of it, I mean, it just doesn't happen. It's never happened since I've been here. We get these, you know, negotiated agreements at the absolute last minute. We have no way to assert our will legislatively in that approval process. We got a gun to our head because the previous contract and its perpetuation is probably worse than the one that we're you know, faced with in the last seconds of a legislative session in a best case scenario. So I'm just expressing some frustration here, Mr. Chairman. This whole process just doesn't work. And so I think we're left only with legislative will. And maybe we should think seriously about starting to pass some bills to the legislature and help the governor out, give him an ability to sign a bill that would actually represent the state's offer and go at it that way. Because this process doesn't work. We'll be out of here before we even hear anything. We'll be summer break before we hear anything.
Representative Benson?
Ms. Holmes, once the offer, the last best offer, has been rejected through the vote that you will receive on or about April the 17th, is it your understanding that you might be released from your data practices secrecy at that point? Would you might be able to share? We'll be back, I'm sure, after this short break that we're going to have to wrap things up. So, and if we look at the end of April timeline, we'd have some opportunity to take a look at that and work with the governor, pass some legislation. So in your mind, would you be released by it once it's voted down and you know that you're going to arbitration at that point?
Ms. Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, based on the IPAD opinions that I have read, and I'd be glad to give you the numbers of those opinions, it states that mediation data, you're not released from that non-public classification until an agreement is reached. And an agreement will either be reached by an acceptance vote of the union or the final decision of the arbitrator.
Ms. Holmes, are you concerned about the length of time? Negotiation period is by far greater than any other that the state's ever been through, the amount of months that it's taken. Are you concerned with that?
Mr. Chairman, there was one other contract that essentially wasn't approved, I believe, till
5 months.
No, I'm thinking there was a Minnesota Nurses Association case that went to arbitration. By the time we received that arbitration, it was very close to the expiration of that actual contract. But normally, you're right. Normally, we would have had most of the contracts settled by this time. Does that concern me? To the extent that I know I've stated before that this is one of the most unusual set of circumstances we have ever found us in because of the scrutiny that the institution of collective bargaining has undergone, because of the fact that we had an incredibly large deficit, and because of the fact of the shutdown. And the fact that negotiations have continued on like this, have taken longer, again, doesn't surprise me, and I don't think should surprise anyone. Do I think that's a good thing? No.
Thank you. Mr. Dale, could you give us a quick update?
Chair Perry, members of the committee, Minnesota State Colleges and Universities negotiates contracts with three units, the instructional State University Instructional Unit, represented by the Interfaculty Organization, the two-year college instructional unit represented by the Minnesota State College faculty, and the administrators professional employees who work with student programs in our state universities, and it's represented by the Minnesota State University Administrative and Service Faculty Organization. Those units are roughly, MSCF is the largest of those three units. It has roughly a headcount of around 4,900. That would be an FTE, and a headcount somewhat higher, probably about 5,500. The IFO is next, and it has an FTE of perhaps about 3,300 and a headcount somewhat higher. And then MUSEF is the smallest of the three units, and it has a FTE total of about 709 employees, and with a headcount, again, somewhat higher. Beginning in February of last year, 2011, we began in earnest bargaining with the Interfaculty Organization, and MSCF followed shortly after that. Both unions indicated a desire to pursue interest-based bargaining. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with interest-based bargaining, but it's a somewhat more time-consuming and laborious process where parties try to commit to addressing the interests of both parties rather than one party just taking a position and trying to force the other party to accede to the first party's will. And we have been meeting with the interfaculty organization every month, either in joint committee or in our drafting subcommittees, since that February date, except for one. MSCF has met somewhat less often, but has met frequently. Probably the total number of bargaining dates with IFO, including these drafting subcommittees, which is a feature of the way we're proceeding through interest-based bargaining, has been somewhere in the vicinity of 20, and MSCF has probably had something akin to 15 or so dates where it has met or either had in the joint committees or in drafting subcommittees. The parties have identified a series of issues, and while we have had a BMS mediator present for our interest-based sessions, we have not formally invoked a mediation, but a feature of the interest-based bargaining process is that the parties need to be able to address the issues without fear that their position will come back to haunt them, since the fundamental element of interest-based bargaining is that everybody in the room is required to address the interests of both parties. It becomes an unnatural situation for the representatives of the union and for management to have to come up with ideas that might address the other party's concerns. As a result, we try to keep what is actually said in the room confidential, but we can talk about the kind of the broad outlines. I would say that these sessions have not dealt with what you would call matters of earth-shaking importance to the parties, but they have been matters that are nonetheless important to the parties. Issues like the procedure for tenure and promotion. The parties have reviewed that issue, for example, through the interest-based bargaining process and come up with some proposals for the parties to take on. Nonetheless, I wouldn't like to address the specifics of those, but I would say that the changes are not earth-shaking, but they're important. These are matters of great importance to the faculty. They're matters of great importance to management. And so what the interest-based bargaining process has allowed us to do is to deal with a lot of issues that would have otherwise been lost or are typically lost through the positional bargaining process, where parties stake out a position and try to essentially force the other party to accede to their will. And then positional bargaining tends to focus on larger, more consequential language issues and, of course, economics. And we have not yet reached the issue of economics through our interest-based bargaining process. I could provide you more information if you'd like, Chair Perry, or you could ask. I'm open for questions.
Senator Representative Drazkowski.
Thanks for the demotion, Mr. Chair. No. Mr. Dale, can you just provide us with kind of maybe a printed list or something of the dates of the meetings for each of these units, and so we've got a chronology to go with? That'd be helpful.
We could do that.
Mr. Dale.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Dale, I've got a couple of questions. Are you aware of an email dated February 9th, 2012, that was sent out by Mr. Roland Jarvis, SCSU faculty negotiator, to I suppose members of that he represents?
Chair Perry, members of the committee, I'm not sure that I am aware of that email.
Well, let me reference some questions from this email. Paragraph 2, he says, we are continuing interest-based negotiating that has governed our meetings over the past year. Interbased contract bargaining and mediated negotiations have never gone on this long before. Would you agree to that?
No.
No?
It's not an act. Senator Perry, if I may, I think the answer may change depending on the exact question being asked. But if the question being asked is similar to the question that you asked Assistant Commissioner Holmes, that is this as long as negotiations have ever gone on after the expiration of the preceding contract with the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, the answer is no. Contract negotiations have gone on longer than this. They have gone into the second year of the biennium, and they did so, I think, most recently it may have been in the 2003-2005 negotiations, but also in the 97-99 negotiations, the contract negotiations went on longer.
Would you have a reasonable answer on why Mr. Jarvis would make a statement like that?
Well, I hate to speculate on what exactly Dr. Jarvis has in mind. I can tell you that he is a colorful and interesting man, and he used to serve as a dean at St. Cloud State. He's returned to the faculty, and it may be that in his role as dean, he was not as closely following the contract negotiations. He had never before participated in negotiations before this round that I am aware of, and it may be that he just simply wasn't following the negotiations that closely.
It goes on to say, I continue to be hopeful for some kind of improvement of faculty remuneration, be that as an additional salary step, larger step amounts, and other additions to the base. Is that part of what the contract negotiations are all about?
The interest-based bargaining has not touched on economic issues, and it has been very clear on the parts of both parties that we are not subjecting the economic items in our contract to interest-based bargaining. I'm sure that Dr. Jarvis is hopeful for improved remuneration. I would say it's probably true of the vast majority of the unit members.
I guess what's concerning to me in the email more so is Mr. Jarvis goes on and talks about the notice from IFO President Larson that he will not seek a second term, and that the negotiating team is anticipating the next IFO president joining our effort to achieve a favorable contract settlement. Goes on to say, such a settlement is not likely to happen before the summer, and the current climate amongst Minnesota lawmakers seems to remain anti-labor. I personally believe that if we presented the legislature with a contract to ratify, they would not accept it if it contained any economic improvement, regardless of any other content changes. I can only hope that the next elected state representatives will be more convinced of the benefits of a capable higher education option for Minnesota's future growth and budget stabilization. You know, to me, that is setting a tone
with membership that we all up here and this legislature is totally against the faculty and the membership. And to me, that just pounds a wedge between the legislature with statements such as that. It also leads me to believe that if negotiations are once or twice a month, that there's really no concern to get a contract done with the hopes that we could extend it long enough to hopefully have a more favorable legislature come November. Is that how you interpret that, or am I?
Chair Perry, members of the committee, I think actually it would probably be best to talk to Dr. Jarvis exactly about what his sentiments are. I'm not sure that he is necessarily representative, although I suspect that there are a fair number of the members of the unit, a fair percentage of the unit, that probably are sympathetic to his views. I would say that actually I think that we have been meeting steadily and we've been working pretty hard at this process. I think both parties have shown a commitment to working through the interest-based issues. It is fair to say that that addressing economic items has been delayed perhaps longer in this round than in prior rounds. Generally, the faculty units have looked at tried to have certain information available to them when they are bargaining over economic items, and that information includes an understanding of what the state insurance package is, and they also generally have liked to have an idea of where the other state settlements are coming in, at what levels they're coming in at. Now, that hasn't always been true. It is true that during the last round after the of negotiations, our state faculty units led the way, and I think that they feel that they took more than their share. Again, I'm speculating somewhat, but I think that they feel that they took more than their fair share of the shared sacrifice by coming in with hard freezes. And I think that they are reluctant, perhaps, to lead the way this time.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Dale, so when did these contracts expire?
Mr. Dale.
The current contracts?
Senator Perry, Representative Downey, the current contracts expired on June 30th, 2011.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I heard you make the comments, we're working hard, we're trying to come to an agreement. I'm sorry, that that falls a little flat when the contracts expired 9 months ago, 8 months ago. That doesn't sound like anybody's working very hard. Frankly, it sounds like people are stalling. And just to confirm, Mr. Neal, so you haven't even started to talk about the economic components. You're just interest-based bargaining, the other working conditions, work rule type issues. Is that a fair statement?
That is a fair statement.
Right? Mr. Dale.
So, Mr. Chairman, we're working very hard to resolve these contract disputes, but they expired 8 months ago. We haven't even started talking, or the administration hasn't even started talking about the economic issues. How long do we have to sit here and hear these reports and I don't know, be made fools of? I mean, this is a joke. I'm sorry, this is just unbelievable to me that we're sitting here hearing from two respective administrations with contracts that expired 8 months ago, telling me you're working very hard, and then on top of that, you seem to be representing quite sympathetically the bargaining unit's positions about who took the lead on taking cuts and things. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this whole process is just unbelievably bad, unbelievably broken, and ridiculous, and I think to sit here and provide this testimony and expect us to take it seriously? I mean, I don't know why we meet and hear this. Let's just go pass legislation and hammer this thing through and let the governor give the governor some support maybe tell the Minsky campuses what they should take as well. This is pointless.
Further comments? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question be for Mr. Dale or Ms. Holmes. I share Representative Downey's frustration. Actually, it's been 9 months. And I'm curious. I mean, it seems to be more than coincidence here that we have now at least five different bargaining units that all seem to be collectively dragging their feet somehow for 9 months. And I'm looking back at the history of the AFSCME and MAPE negotiations over the last 20 years, and many of them have taken 0, 2, 2.5, 4.5, 5 months, 2.5 months, 1.5 months, 3 months, 6.5, which is a high number, 1.5 months, 7.5 months, 1 month, 1.5, 1.0, 2.0 months. It seems more than coincidence that all five of these are at this point at 9 months, and as Representative Downey articulated so well, in these three, Mr. Dale, that you're talking about, you're just doing the non-economic factors now. What was different then what was different then that doesn't exist now, or what existed then that doesn't exist now? Why is it that all five of these processes are simultaneously where they're at now?
Mr. Dale.
Senator Perry, Representative Drazkowski, members of the committee, as I indicated earlier, this is actually not unusual for settlements with respect to the faculty units. Faculty units have tended to take longer to settle, and they have been more protracted, and I would have to say often more difficult. So it is not out of the ordinary to not be resolved at this point. It is perhaps longer than we have in the past discussed economic items, but we have been engaged in a process which I think the parties believe has been quite productive taught through the interest-based bargaining process.
Ms. Holmes, would you like to respond to?
Mr. Chairman, again, there are a number of factors, and one of them, one of the first ones is the fact that this body and the governor were unable to reach agreement about a budget, and that put things behind, and the shutdown put things behind. And we have a situation where, and I'm not trying to advocate for the unions, but they have been unable to secure any wage increases for the past 4 years. And again, we're faced with a big deficit. And regardless of what's justified, it's been a very difficult negotiations with them.
Representative Drazkowski.
Mr. Chair, well, Ms. Holmes, you know, I understand that, you know, they may be looking at, maybe I don't understand. You know, over the last couple of years, the private sector has taken huge decreases in their compensation. And anyway, I'm just sharing my frustrations with the expectations that you articulated. Mr. Dale, do you believe that if we didn't have the type of end of post contract termination terms that we do have now, where you've got the autopilot increases that happen in both insurance and compensation, which I assume is underway in the three contracts that you're talking about, do you believe if those weren't there that we'd have maybe a more agile process than you seem to be communicating to us that has happened over the last apparently many years and is very pronounced this year?
Mr. Dale.
Senator Perry, Representative Drazkowski, members of the subcommittee, I may not be the right person to ask this question because while the contract continuation provisions of PELRA apply to the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities just as they do to the rest of the state, our contracts are set up somewhat differently. And so the typical increases in compensation that have happened with the classified units don't on an annual basis do not happen with the faculty contracts. So it is fair to say, for example, that during the last year there have been no step increases and no across-the-board increases for our faculty while the contracts have remained in effect. And so the hard freeze that was agreed to during the last biennium continues with them. So it would be speculation to think that some other, for me, to think that some other set of incentives would motivate the faculty and perhaps management to move more quickly to settlement. I mean, I suppose one could say that's an inducement to management not to settle because they're enjoying the benefits of a hard freeze at this time. But that hasn't been our inducement. We've been working through the interest-based bargaining process trying to address the issues that have been raised through that process. I'm not sure if that is answering your question, Representative Draskowski, but if I can offer more, let me know.
It has. Thank you.
We have Representative Benson, then we'll go to the other side of the aisle. Too. Yeah.
Well, you can tell from the line of questioning and maybe some of the frustration that if there was a headline in tomorrow's paper to be written, it would be state employee labor negotiations stalled, state employee and university labor union successfully stalled negotiations and hope for a better outcome from new legislature to be elected in November. The question is of the committee, is there collusion? You can sense the frustration. And certainly, not having now an opportunity for this current legislative body to be able to weigh in on the question has even made it far more frustrating.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Dale, you say that this protracted negotiation is not unusual. I'll need to see some evidence of that. So if you could get us the history as Ms. Holmes has provided us, I would appreciate that. And Ms. Holmes, you contend that the government shutdown was a major factor, and you've said it a number of times, that it was a major factor. The previous shutdown was 6 days shorter, and yet they completed their negotiations 2.5 months after the previous contract expired. So I am going to strongly disagree with your contention and join my colleagues in saying I'm guessing that there are significant other factors. And so if you could please take that mindset with you when you go back to negotiating, don't give yourself the backdoor excuse. All of these bargaining units are walking the same walk, and they're just waiting this out. And it is our job to back up the governor and protect the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota. And while we are at an information disadvantage, this is not pretty, and it's not going to end well.
Ms. Holmes.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, I believe in that previous shutdown, that was a partial shutdown, and there were some of the omnibus finance bills that were passed, and one of the bills that was passed was the bill that funded state agencies. So it was a little bit different, and the only other comment I want to make is regarding Representative Benson's statement is the governor. Felt very strongly and pushed to have this offer to settle put across the table to get it to a vote of the union members. And that's the action that's being taken. That was the action that needed to be taken to get a contract to you, and it has been taken.
Representative Benson.
I have to respond. I'm wondering why the governor didn't feel compelled to do that last October. You know, it's when is it now? And, we're March or April 2nd, and he could have easily put his foot down, so to speak, and said we need to get this done or wrapped up a lot sooner than he did. And I have not seen that level of leadership at this point.
Any further questions or comments? I guess I would, Representative Benson, I think I have a better headline for the papers tomorrow. Mine would be something like, it appears that the unions are more transparent with their membership than the Dayton administration is with the citizens of the state when it comes to negotiations. And that is so totally unfortunate that's happening right now. And I don't think the frustration just sits at this table with the fact that the contracts appear to be stalled. I think there's many citizens out there wondering what's really happening because they're not hearing anything. And they're concerned about that, and so are we. Anything else from the committee? Ms. Holmes, Mr. Dale, thank you very much for being here at the committee. We have one item we want to move on, and that's approval of the minutes. Senator Benson, do you renew your motion?
I'll renew my motion to move the minutes as presented.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Motion prevails. There being no further business before the committee, we are adjourned.